Morning, everyone. The first thing I want to say is a huge thank you to Genuine HSE for asking me to speak to you this morning. In case you're wondering why I'm wearing a roving mic, I have a terrible tendency to walk about and then have to be told to get back, so hence they put this on me this morning. There have been so many interesting things spoken about this morning already, and I want to focus on the idea of how you live as individuals in your entire life, not just in your working life, and how that impacts on the way you work with people who are living with dementia and the families who are working so hard to support them. So I'm going to ask for a little trust, first of all, because it's slightly different to some of the presentations you've already heard and a slightly different focus. So I'm kind of hoping you'll just open your heart a little and trust me for the next 20-25 minutes or so in what we're going to talk about. The idea of living well is something that we've heard about often in the context of dementia over the last number of years. That type of language has permeated our discussions really probably for the last probably 20 years. So it's not a concept that's new, but we kind of have been looking at it somehow as separate from generally for all of us how we want to live well. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit this morning about family, first of all, to introduce and set the scene. And I think the easiest way to do that is to probably talk a little bit about my own experience as a member of a family caring for someone with dementia. I probably should have said at the beginning, that's what brings me here. That's why I've ended up here. My mum had early onset dementia in her late 50s, and she died age 75 in 2012. So it was quite a long journey for her and for us. It was nearly 20 years in total. And we were faced with the challenges that each and every one of you, I guess, are faced with when you walk into a family in this situation. I was living in Ireland. My siblings all live abroad. I have two sisters in New York, a brother in London, and I was working full time. I was a single parent. And my mum had been talking to me about how she felt things weren't quite right, and she was worried. And so began our journey with dementia. What I can tell you is that I was scared beyond belief. I was angry a lot of the time. I was frustrated. I was desperate. I was exhausted. I was getting lots of wonderfully sound advice from two sisters at the far side of a phone telling me what I should be doing and why didn't I try this and why didn't I try that. They were also scared and angry and worried and didn't know what to do next. I had a brother in London who just simply did not know what to do to support any of us. And there we all are, muddling around, trying to find our way. Now, that doesn't even begin to touch on my mum's journey with her dementia in the midst of this, because she was just scared all the time. That's my most vivid recollection of it, is her fear. And everything that had supported her for most of her life, she kind of felt was disappearing. And even when it was still there for her and her particular journey, she couldn't seem to find a way to access it. And I don't imagine that my family situation is particularly unique. In fact, I know from talking to other people who have tried to support someone with dementia and to people who have a dementia, that it's not unique at all. And those emotions are common to most people who are going through this. That's the type of environment that as professionals you're walking into. You know, you're not walking into this kind of environment where you can simply focus on the professional duty and the skills and the tasks that you know how to get done. You are stepping into the middle of this, what could be chaos. You know, you have arrived. You are the professional. We're all looking to you. For many people, when you arrive in, what's happened is they've maybe only recently got a diagnosis. And somehow, sometimes getting that diagnosis, a sense of, okay, now I know what we're dealing with. Now we'll be able to place some order on this. There'll be a structure. We'll be able to sort it out. And sometimes that isn't the case. And I think whether we like it or not as professionals in the field, you are now part of this. You are in it and of it for while you are part of it. So all of those emotions, the fear, the sadness, the loss, the grief, the anger that is occurring both within that family and their wider circle, you may not want them to be your business, but they are your business. And it's kind of a disservice both to you and to the people you're working with not to actually acknowledge that. That this is what's here, this is what is alive in this room, in this moment, is all of this emotion and all of this struggle. And the other thing is all of the expectation for what you're going to do. The miracles that someone is hoping you will be able to deliver. Because I certainly know when we first accessed some of the more, you know, from social services to nurses who were working in the field, all my hope was invested in what they would bring to me. I was blissfully unaware of the environment they were working in. And some of the things that have been talked about already this morning, and about the resources that you don't have, the time that you don't have, the knowledge that you want more of. I didn't care. I just wanted someone to help me to find my way through this. So you're in a really, there's that word again, challenging position when you move in with this family. And the risk, I think, is that by donning a very professional cloak, and I'll be talking about that again, then you can kind of stay safe with it because it's, well, we can do this and we can do that, but no, we don't have that. And there's an opportunity to sort of place yourself here, just a step back, not actually in it, with it, and of it. So here you are, the professionals, you've arrived. We're all hoping you're going to sort it out. And you're looking in on this situation and wondering, what can you possibly do? So I suppose for the rest of the presentation, what I'm not going to be doing is talking about the specifics of how you do your job. You don't need me to do that. You know it better than I know it. But I want to talk instead about what you have in common with these families, what you share with them, your common humanity, if you like. Because in truth, we are all on this journey of life, trying to find our way through it. We are all, to varying degrees, familiar with loss, with sadness, with grief, with struggle. You are not so different from this family, even if you have not experienced exactly what they're experiencing. The emotions, the challenges, will face each and every one of us at some point in our lives. So you share a lot as a human being, not as a social worker, an OT, a physical therapist, whatever it is. You share a lot as a human being with these families. So that brings us to something we're all very familiar with in the field, the notion of person-centered. And that brings me back to the idea I was speaking about, the professional cloak. In all of our, I don't imagine there's anyone in this room now working who hasn't heard about the philosophy of being person-centered in the way they work. And, you know, for example, in homes, residential homes, nursing homes, in all sorts of environments, we've all seen, you know, the charts where you fill in about taking a person-centered approach, about making sure that people have choice, all of these things. And much of that work began with Kitwood, but in truth, Kitwood was informed by Carl Rogers. Carl Rogers was the therapist who really first pioneered the idea of being person-centered. But he argued that being person-centered is not something that you put on to do your job and take off again when you're done. Person-centered is a way of being as a human being. It's not something we do in our jobs. You have to live it. There is no other way to truly be person-centered than to commit to living in a person-centered way. And actually, if you are committing to living in a person-centered way, then that naturally flows through your work. If you're trying to put it on when you get into the job, and I don't mean actually, that sounds wrong, put it on. I don't mean pretend, but if you're trying to be person-centered when you're at work and you go home and somehow that's something you do for your job, that's not person-centered. It is truly a way of living your life. Carl Rogers said that before each session, he takes a moment to remember his humanity. There is no experience that this man has I cannot share with him, no fear I cannot understand, no suffering I cannot care about, because I too am human. You know, quite often there's this notion, I also work as a counsellor and a life coach, that, you know, you can't work with people if they have a completely different experience to you. But you can, because we all share, as I've already talked about, in those common emotions and responses to our challenges in life. So, I want to talk to you about how to begin to move towards, well, you may all be living in this way, trying to live a more person-centered, more compassionate life, and how that can support you in the work that you're trying to do with a family. And one of the key things, and probably what the rest of this will lead to, is about developing self-compassion. You're a group of people and your compassion is called on, I would guess, every single day. You know, this is the type of work you're doing. You are called upon to be compassionate with the people you work with every single day. And in some ways, that's easier. We can all feel enormous compassion for other people. But I wonder how many of you offer yourselves the same level of compassion. You know, so how often is the voice in your head? We all have scripts that are running around in our heads. And how many of you have a script that says, you know what, you did a great job today. You know, that was marvelous. I'm so pleased that you did so well. Or how many of you have the script are going, I can't believe you did that. Did you actually say that out loud? By way of example, in preparation for coming here today, I was supposed to have my presentation ready for last Tuesday, and it wasn't. And I had family staying with me from New York. I'd been busy for a couple of weeks before that, and I knew that I had to contact Anne-Marie, who's sitting at the table here, and tell her it's not ready. And the voice in my head went, you're always so slow. I can't believe you're not ready. What are they going to think about you now? Yeah, I bet you they think, why ask her? That's where the voice started. So I had to rein her back. Her name is Margaret in my head. No offense to any Margarets in the room, but I don't know why, but I have named my inner critic Margaret. And I had to rein Margaret right in and remind her that I had my sister's in from New York, who are only in once a year. I had been busy, and I was doing my best. And gather myself and send an email that said, I am trying to practice what I preach, and I'm telling you it's not ready, but I will be ready on the day. But it cost me, you know, in that struggle. And again, I don't think I'm unique in that we are much more inclined to berate ourselves and remind ourselves of what we've not done. You know, if you take another example, if say you were in your workplace and on Monday you do something that you kind of feel was a bit stupid and everybody saw it, okay, all of your colleagues saw it, and in fact somebody made a bit of a joke about it. And on Wednesday your boss called you in and commended you for doing a fabulous job in something else. On Friday, which one's going right in your head? Monday's mistake. We're kind of predisposed to focus on the negative. As human beings, we are drawn to the negative scripts. In fact, it takes, I think it's five, there are five negative thoughts really for every one positive. So we're inclined to focus on that. And we're not inclined to be kind to ourselves. But when we learn that kindness and the art of developing some compassion for ourselves, what it does is it opens our heart. Not just for ourselves, but the other people who are in our world and the people who we are trying to support. It's not about self-pity. It's not about weakness. It's actually about strength. And in terms of the way the field has been developing, self-compassion is now recognized as much more powerful than self-esteem. Because self-esteem is actually viewed to how your peers view you. Where self-compassion is the art of learning to be kind even when we screw it up. And we will. We are imperfect human beings leading imperfect lives. We are going to get it wrong. So the art of learning to be kind when we mess it up is much more important than we know. Because just as we've all acknowledged, that kind of negative, toxic script is running, not silently, God, I wish it was silent, but quietly in our heads almost all of the time. So quietly that the danger is most of the time we don't even notice it. It's talking away, reminding you of what you didn't do. And oh yeah, look, they saw you again. Yeah, that's just right. But it's been there so long and it's grown in strength that we actually don't notice it. If you took a day where you decided to pay attention to all the thoughts that were popping into your head, you would be astonished at how many of them are not kind. You really would. So what I'm saying is that the art of self-compassion is really crucial if you want to move towards a happier, more open, more reflective way of life. And that brings me to some of the research to remind you that this is not just Patricia who wants you to live a very happy, lovely life. This is what the research tells us about people who are self-compassionate. They are more motivated. They are less afraid of failure because that fear of failure is crucial for each and every one of us. Actually, sometimes we'd rather not do it than do it and risk getting it wrong. And in a professional capacity, where we're bound by so many systems and so many procedures, you can see how that could really influence what you do. But as you grow kinder to yourself and less judgmental when you make a mistake, you are going to be less afraid of those mistakes and of getting it wrong. You become more self-confident. At a physical level, self-compassionate people are more likely to eat well, they have stronger immune systems, and they are more likely to take exercise. I'll bet you can't wait. Yeah. So, one of the stages of self-compassion is about forgiveness. And this is a really thorny one for most of us. Because we're not just talking about forgiveness for other people, although that also is crucial. I'm sure you've all heard the idea that to hold on to anger and withhold forgiveness is like drinking a glass of poison and expecting the other person to die. Because that's effectively what you're doing. If you're really holding a grudge against someone, and you know, and every time you see them, that script sets off in your head about what they did and about why they were wrong, and you'll never look at them the same again, and they're oblivious. They're having a great time in the corner of the room and you're miserable because all that you can think about is the script that's going on in your head. But harsh as we are sometimes with other people, we are much more harsh with ourselves and in withholding forgiveness. But go back to the example. When you made the mistake, that's the thing on the Friday that's still spinning round and round in your head. Instead of reminding yourself you did a great job on Wednesday, and yeah, you screwed up, but that's okay. You're going over and over and over and withholding forgiveness from yourself. Then why would we do that? To what end? It's not serving a purpose. It's not going to make you a better person. And the difficulty with it is, when you are stuck back in that annoyance about what you did, you're not here. You're not present. You're not in this moment, in this room. You're stuck back there where you got it wrong. So there are some steps, you know, whether it is with someone else or whether it is with yourself. If you did something wrong, acknowledge it. Because the other thing we're inclined to do is to deny it. Okay, you just push it back there, tuck it in, and hope that it'll go away. Well, the truth is, with anything that we try to deny or resist, you know, if you put it in here in this corner down there, as sure as anything, it's going to sneak up here, and there it is. It's out in another form. You ever had anyone say something to you, a routine thing in a conversation, and you respond in a way that even you go, oh my God, where did that come from? Well, they've set off some trigger about some old thing that upset you maybe 10 years ago, but it's pushed an old button and here we go. Today and now it's interfering with the way you live. So acknowledging what you've done without judgment, without blame, and simply saying, you know, I really didn't like the way that I behaved. I'm sorry that I behaved that way. I wish it had been different. But I have learned, and I won't choose to behave in that way again. If it's something that happened a long time ago and there is no way for you to decide to make amends for it, if you can make amends, then do. Just do it. If it means, you know, that you've been triggered to remember something this morning, then go outside, lift the phone, call the person and say, I'm sorry. Let it go. Be done with it. And if it's not possible to make amends, well then maybe choose to do something nice for someone in the name of it. Your random act of kindness for the day. Except it's not really so random. But so taking the steps to move, time is running out, towards forgiveness. Okay, the next thing is to talk to you about being present. Living well requires being in the present, anchored in the here and now, which is what we've really been talking about here this morning. If you are working with a family and you're driving into that environment and as you arrive, you're thinking about the last meeting you left, or perhaps you're thinking about the meeting you had with a family the last time that didn't go well, and you carry that into this encounter, that is going to colour what you see and how you respond. Taking a moment before you enter any environment, whether it be your work or your personal life, to actually take a breath and bring yourself back to this moment right now, not caught in the past, not thinking about, if I get out of here by 4:10, then I'll be able to get home in time to make the dinner, and then I'll get the kids sorted out, which we all do. We're usually somewhere in the past or we're in the future, but it's very difficult for us to be in this moment right now. To be open. And that's where this way of living is about being open. So that's the forgiveness, allowing yourself to consider things differently, the self-compassion. It's really an attitude of growth. So it's looking on your mistakes instead of as a failure, but looking on them as an opportunity to learn. When you see someone and you look at them and feel that you're stupid because you'll never be like them, instead of that, looking at them thinking, what can I learn? How can I learn from this person? It kind of just shifts you to a different place. And in that more open place, there is much more opportunity for you to move towards a solution way of thinking rather than a problem-based way of thinking. I'm conscious that I'm having to rush this. Amory, how much time? Oh, Lord. Okay. Anyone who's heard me speak before know this is very close to my heart. A lot of the workshops I deliver are around gratitude and the theme of gratitude. My experience of gratitude has been that it is utterly transformational. And if you want to take a first step on this path, gratitude is the way to do it. The research in gratitude shows us that people who live grateful lives have more joy in their lives, more enthusiasm, more love, more happiness, and more optimism. They are better protected from envy, from resentment, from greed. They have more resilience. They recover more quickly from illness. Basically, it's an all-round win-win. And the idea that lots of the time we think about, well, you know, it's easy to be grateful if you're living this great life. But if they had my life, I'd like them to be grateful then. But the truth is, grateful people are happy people. Not happy people are grateful people. That's the way it works. When you start to move into a space of gratitude, your perspective shifts. And it happens actually almost invisibly, that somehow you start to notice differently. And when your perspective shifts, again, it is that opening up of a space for looking at things differently, for finding solutions, for being more creative, because you're not stuck in those old patterns. You have more energy as well, because negative thinking is proven to reduce the level of energy we have, whereas positive thinking increases our level of energy. Gratitude teaches us to appreciate the rainbow and the storm. It's very difficult to suggest to people that they should be, that they can be grateful in the midst of difficult times. But history shows us it's true. And that if we can work from a place of gratitude, then we can appreciate even the toughest of times. And even if not in that very moment, certainly in retrospect, we learn to appreciate the most difficult of times, because we can appreciate that perhaps we have learned patience. We have learned about finding our voice to speak for someone else. My mom's own condition, I spent a lot of time when my mom had dementia, fighting dementia. I was determined I was going to win. I had no chance of actually winning. There was no battle to be won. And I think the language of battle that we use in terms of dementia is not particularly helpful. But when I was able to move more to a place of acceptance, that first of all, this was her journey, not mine, and that I could not take it for her, and also of where my place in it was, I once again became her daughter. When I became grateful for the moments that were so precious, it offered me an opportunity to once again have that mother-daughter relationship, regardless of where my mom was in her journey. Practicing gratitude, very quickly to finish up, there are things you can do. The first thing, in order to be grateful, you have to notice, you have to appreciate, and then you have to give thanks. So if you don't notice it happening, you're never going to give thanks for it. So if it is, I don't know, the lady who held the door open as you were struggling through with your suitcase, whether it was the 2-year-old playing on the beach that turned around for a moment and smiled at you. These tiny moments in each of our days are an opportunity to be grateful. When you wake up and you're able to step out of your bed grateful for another day, when you notice that there is food on your table, when there's a monk who writes about gratitude and he talks about when he was living in Africa, how when he came home and he turned on the tap and there was running water, he was like, and yet you and I turn on running water every day and we don't even give it a second thought that actually this is not the case for most people in the world. Having a light switch, having an opportunity like today to notice, to appreciate, and then to give thanks. One of the practices that can literally change your life is keeping a gratitude journal. And that's taking the time each and every day to write down some of the things that you're grateful for. And you can start with the basics, roof over my head, food on my table, a family I love. But then moving into the detail. And it's the detail of every day that will remind you of the joy of it. I have to finish. This line, with mindfulness, loving kindness and self-compassion, we can begin to let go of our expectations about how life and those we love should be. Should is one of the most dangerous words in our vocabulary. And you heard me slip into it once there. Recipe for living well, from my perspective, self-compassion, forgiveness, being present, open, and grateful. I am by no means suggesting that this is a glib or easy way, or in fact that it's not challenging, and I told you about my own struggles having to face that last week just at a small level. But I promise you, it is transformational, It will not only change the way you live, but the way that you work with people with dementia and their families, because it is about being present. There were several people speaking before me who talked about how significant and how important it is that someone feels truly heard, that they're asked what they need, that we're not caught in the system and what we have in our heads that we usually do or that people usually need. This opens you up to just being with someone in a moment right now, regardless of circumstance. I'm so sorry that I ran over a little. Thank you very much, and I'll be here at lunchtime.